him. Strike, dear mistress, and cure his heart. Fancies chase the costumes she shall wear. Ermine furs adorn imperious. Severin, Severin awaits you there.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. That was a little Velvet Underground to start us out for the day. Slow but steady is the phrase goes. That song was picked for a particular reason. Today's guest is Craig Yeo. Did I get it right? I forgot to double check.
Yeah, Craig Yeo.
Okay. And Craig is I guess, comics historian extraordinaire. I'm not going to name...
Quote you?
Huh?
Can I quote you?
Sure.
Cool.
I'd be fine with that. A little poll quote from the Ink Studs. I'm not going to list all the books, the main ones, the comic ARF, ARF Forum, et cetera, from Fantagraphics. This week we're chatting about two particular books. We'll start out with The Secret Identity, the fetish art of Superman's co-creator, Joe Shuster.
Right, that's an Abrams book, that particular one.
The fantastic, part of the new line from Abrams, their comic art, is that what it's called?
Comics arts. Comics art, I think.
Comic arts with the S at the end. The arts, yeah, is plural. Which is accurate, because comics are multidisciplinary art form, I guess.
And they are an art. And this is actually the first book in their new line. It's being edited by Charlie Kochman there, who's a fine fellow. And he's got all kinds of great books coming out in his line, but I was fortunate and proud to be the first to kick off his imprint at Abrams.
It's funny, because your book is very different from all the other books in some ways.
The book is not like the others.
One of these is not like the others. I guess there are some similarities. One of them was the erotic comics, which is kind of a history. And then there's the Laugh Out Loud Cats, which, I'm sorry, did not appeal to me.
You didn't laugh out loud.
I did not laugh out loud. I have yet to really get the joke, maybe.
I've heard good things about it. I haven't read it yet, though, so...
Yeah, well... Oh. My headphones. There we go. Okay. I'm sorry. I'm having technical difficulties. I stepped on something I shouldn't have. Yes. Let's get back to your book, though. We don't need to talk about the
cats.
Oh,
that's great. Good idea.
But I am excited about the Jaime Hernandez, Todd Hignutti book. That sounds fantastic. On a side note. Secret Identity. Let's look a little background on the book, I guess.
Well, it is the title pretty much does explain the overall thrust is the secret identity, the fetish art of Superman's co-creator Joe Shuster. And a couple of years ago, Rob and I was at a antique book sale, and I noticed one dealer had this old dusty cardboard box in the far corner of his booth, and decided to peer in, and lo and behold, there was this kind of adults only 50s pornographic kind of amateurishly produced booklets, and but one did really stand out because the artwork was great, and I immediately recognized that the artwork was by the guy who created superheroes, the guy who created the comic book industry with his partner Jerry Siegel, Joe Shuster. It was the artist, creating artist of Superman. It was his work, and that just like blew my mind. This booklet was called Knights of Horror, and it was this...
Knights of Horror or Horror?
Horror. Okay. H-O-R-R-O-R.
Just thought I'd double check.
Like scary kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Horror movies? That's probably my Midwest U.S. accent. mixing it up with some other word that I don't even know about. But, so there, this booklet was a Knights of Horror booklet. And in one in a series of 16, as it turned out, and it's full of S&M kind of pulpish kind of stories that are illustrated by Joe Shuster. He had about 10 full-page illustrations in each one of these booklets, kind of small size, and just but pack a powerful punch because Joe's great artwork and the sorted subject matter. You know, it's like the characters even kind of look like Superman or Lois Lane or Clark Kent or Jimmy Olsen or even Lex Luthor. So they're of course not those characters, but they sure are dead
darn close
for them. Yeah, they look kind of like characters without clothes. I showed this book to Mort Walker, the creator of Beetle Bailey, last night. I said, "There's one illustration of this." Girl sans clothing, and she's being grabbed by two hooded figures, and one is about to stick a syringe needle in her naked breast, and I said, doesn't this look like Lois Lane? He goes, the body sure does. he's ever the very, very funny guy. I love Mort Walker and his sense of humor. He's always on, though. He's a funny guy. Anyway, the characters do look like citizens of Metropolis gone wild, and very wild.
It's odd. The hooded characters are one of the most unusual things. I was looking through this book with a friend, and it's like we're trying to figure out what the deal was with the hooded characters.
Well, I think, you know, these booklets were done in the mid-1950s, 1953, probably to be exact, and probably to be exact. Boy, I'm a great historian. So they were done in, like, 1953, and, you know, during the height of Ku Klux Klan mania, and I think it was... I think they're progressive in many ways. They're progressive in their frank sexuality and sexual fantasy. And they're also like, you know, it's kind of, it was a good and brave and cool thing that he was saying that people, you know, that are, that go around wearing hoods and pushing their own ideologies, you know, are bad people or villainous types. And there are a lot of hooded villains in these stories, but I think it kind of was a thing of the times. And then I even noted that there's a few black characters in these stories that Joe delineated, and they're very, even though these, I mean, most of the characters in these books are villainous in one sort or another. There's very few heroes, but there's a lot of villains, but a couple of them are black, but they're kind of drawn in a respectful way. You know, they're like, unlike many cartoons, he didn't like overly exaggerate the features or something for like comic effect. Or
mm-hmm. Not like Ebony from The Spirit.
Right. So, exactly. And so I think it even, you know, some people don't like this material much, but I think you got to admire Joe for the brilliant artwork he was doing.
The gumption?
Yeah, and the gumption, and also, like, socially, they were kind of progressive in that men and women were both whippers and whippies, you know, there was equal opportunity whipping, and people were drawn respectfully, and hooded figures were, you know, put down as being bad, and, you know, I admire Joe so much, especially after, you know, creating the superhero in the comic book industry, but for this material too, it's just it's him at the top of his form. He was doing beautiful artwork, and then there's interesting themes here that he should get credit for, not condemnation. In my book, in fact, in my book,
read the book. Now, at this, what was he doing?
I don't care if you read it. Buy the book.
Buy the book. Peek through it. Flip. What was he doing creatively at the time when he was producing these?
When he did this, not much of anything. He in 1948, he and his writing partner, Jerry Siegel, sued DC Comics because they had sold Superman to DC for $130 that they split between them. So Joe got $65. So they sold the rights to the character for that. They did make a lot of money doing Superman comic books and the Superman comic strip. They were probably making today's equivalent of about $1 million a year each for about 8 or 9, maybe 10 years. But then it really bugged the heck out of them that DC owned the character and that you know, they had no guarantee for mm-hmm. kind of money. And in fact, the relationship was kind of up and down with DC through the years. So they wanted to try to get the character back and the rights. And so they met up with this lawyer who convinced them that was a good idea. And so they sued DC in 1948. And lost. It really kind of, in the judge's mind, was an open and shut case where DC did own the characters. And so Jerry and Joe became persona non grata at DC. Their names were taken off the credits, and they stopped getting, you know, assignments and money from DC. And I think maybe with all that money they earned, maybe Joe and maybe Jerry too had kind of just ran through the money. They thought it was going to be there forever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You live like a rock star, I know, Robin. So you know,
saw my heaving
life, so
backpack.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So I think he kind of was out of work by 1953. You know, we only know that he was doing like kind of odd jobs, like sweeping up in stores and being an errand boy and things like that. So, and working on a few ideas, but nothing had come to fruition. So, you know, he did need the money when he met up, you know, with the people that wanted to produce these booklets. The publisher was a mafioso type. He was like a Jewish mobster who owned bookstores in Times Square and needed stuff for his patrons, you know, a special customers who demanded this kind of S&M kind of stuff. So he had Joe and this writer, Clancy, put together these booklets. And, you know, so this, and Joe got like about $100 a book, which doesn't sound like much, but, you know, 10 illustrations would probably equal a couple pages of comic book stories. And so, you know, $50 a page for a comic book story wasn't bad money back then. But I'm not saying he got rich off of this particular thing at all. I mean, you know, in fact, you know, it didn't last for a long time because there was problems down the road on it.
How does this fit in the spectrum of the illicit material that was coming out at the time?
Well, there was other kinds of stuff. Eric Stanton was doing bondage artwork, and Betty Page was, you know, doing her modeling. I think it kind of fits into that whole kind of thing. And, you know, if you've read about Betty Page or some problems with in her photographer, Irving Claw, and his problems with the government, you kind of know all the kinds of things that were.
Well, she didn't even get rights for her work until well into her later years, wasn't it?
I'm not sure she ever really owned any rights to her work.
Just her name.
Yeah, her name, and then I think people, started feeling that it was just to pay her to, at least some people, when they reprinted her work. I just did another book called Sexology, which is a collection of articles from a magazine that started in the 1930s, it was like kind of a pseudo-science social magazine, but really just an excuse to talk about sex. They had a weird kind of scientific articles like about homosexual chickens or sociological looks about Hitler's sex life or all kinds of crazy kinds of things. But that I dedicated that book, The Best of Sexology, which collected all these magazine articles, to Betty Page because I had... Not just because I had a picture of her reading the magazine that I was able to put with a dedication, but I certainly do, love her persona and her image, and I think she was a pretty cool and progressive lady. Just like I think Joe was pretty progressive in illustrating these sexual fantasies, at the time,
Wasn't this
taking a lot of risk? This kind of material was illegal.
Mm-hmm. Was this around the same time that Joe Willie's Bazaar was coming up too?
Yes, right, exactly.
Where he was doing the photos that was the How to Defend Yourself as a way of framing people and being tied up.
Right. Yeah, all those kind of photos and drawings. I think Eric Stanton did artwork for that too, didn't he? Or was it just?
I think he did.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly, but
me neither.
I'm going to do a quick song break, and then when we get back in. Why don't we talk about the legal difficulties?
Yeah, that sounds great.
What would you like to hear?
Me?
Yeah, Whippet or The Stones?
Whippet would be good in the context of all the sadomasochistic talk here.
There we go. Stay tuned. Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. We'll be right back.
Give the past a slip. Step on a grid. say whip it. Whip it good. I say whip it. Whip it good.
CITR 101.9 FM, that was Devo with the always classic Whip It. My guest this week, if you're listening, is Craig Yao, and we are discussing currently the secret identity, the fetish art of Superman's co-creator, Joe Shuster. Which,
you know, those Devo guys, they went to my high school.
Really?
Yeah.
In Ohio?
Akron, Ohio.
I just had a couple months ago, Durf on, who did great comic.
Yeah, I'm anxious to read that comic he did. I guess about the kind of Akron punk scene or something, which a lot of my pals were involved in. Not me so much.
You're too busy reading comics.
Yeah, maybe. I think sort of that and some other things, but I was around that time running a nightclub, and so some of the musicians that got involved in that scene, played at my nightclub. Like that, so
it's a good book,
but I did kind of get off into other things. And they went on to create what was once touted as Akron was being said that it was going to be the next Liverpool or something. Didn't quite happen that way, but I think there was, from what I know, there was some great music that came out of it. Some great artists like Durf and a musician named Harvey Gold, and there's this old pal of mine named Nick. I can't remember what his last name was, but he was a real mover and shaker kind of behind that whole music scene. How did we get off into that?
Ohio.
Oh, Whip It.
Whip It.
Devo.
The Devo.
Yeah.
The music being appropriate to the topic at hand.
Yeah, whips and chains.
Whips and chains and
good stuff.
Venus and Furs, also being in the same subject, which I was mentioning earlier before we actually got on air, was probably sold. The book at that time would have been sold in the same shops that would have sold.
Yeah, right, for sure.
And Velvet Underground was also a naughty book.
There was one of the titles for the Knights of War books that Joe Shuster illustrated was called The Bride Wore Leather. I always thought that was kind of similar to Venus and Furs.
There we go.
So it kind of resonates in the same way.
It all fits.
Yeah.
Now, the legal troubles. Actually, I something before we get to that is, what did Joe think of this work? Did he ever talk about it, or is this only from your research of finding it, and you kind of...
Well, I never got some authoritative quote from him. I mean, he didn't sign the work because, like we were saying before, it's highly illegal to do this kind of stuff, though it's clearly his work. And, the book, first book signing I had at the New York Comic Con, when the book had just come out, in fact, we had only flown a few in from, China to sell there and kind of advanced copies, but some guy that was first in line that said, told me that when he was 18, he was a volunteer at the New York Comic Con that was happening back in 1971, and that he was assigned to Joe Shuster to get him around the convention and make sure he was at his talks on time and had lunch and all that kind of good stuff. And at a certain point in the day, Joe asked him if he would give him, if he had a car and he could give him a ride back to his apartment because he wanted to get some artwork that he wanted to sell at the convention or some things like that. And while he was there, some artwork that he showed him, he went into the back room and came out and opened up a portfolio, and lo and behold, it was like this S&M kind of stuff. And you know, and he said to the guy, he said, "You ever seen anything like this before?" He said no, and Joe, you know, turned the page and said, "Well, we all kind of have had our indiscretions in the past." And just kind of smiled or something. And then, so that was the story the guy told me. So, you know, apparently he wasn't so totally ashamed of it that he never ever showed it to anybody. But I don't think it was something back in the 50s or even that in 1971 that you necessarily would, you know, tell everybody about or go on record talking about or, you know, in an interview or something like that. But, you know, I think he seemed to enjoy doing the figure work in this, and they're beautiful figures, and he rendered them exquisitely, and how much he liked or disliked the actual subject matter, I really couldn't say.
Well, I mean, you contrast it. I heard someone asking about this, because I would, just so folks know, we were at the Toronto Comic and Art Festival this past weekend. Very lovely weekend. Too many comics were bought. And then someone's asking you about Tijuana Bibles.
Right.
And how that, because there's a definite difference in style between this and the Tijuana Bibles, where there's a lot more craftsmanship, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, most of the Tijuana Bibles, with a few nice exceptions, were totally hurriedly done and by very amateurish artists. And, you know, and in some ways, they're cruder artwork-wise and cruder. Well, I don't know how you would define it, though. I mean, they show genitalia and penetration and stuff like that. This is more work by Joe Shuster, Superman's creator. It's more on the S&M side, and it's more interested in you know, bondage and discipline and torture and kind of pulpish kind of stories, where the Tijuana Bibles were kind of jokey stories and just eight panels is hence their name. But well, they besides being called Tijuana Bibles, they were called eight pagers. You know, I mean, they're kind of a different animal. I mean, similar, but different.
Well, these aren't gag strips. I think that's something to definitely
funny about these.
There's a couple of them that are funny.
Well, maybe only funny from our viewpoint or in retrospect, or I don't know. I don't think they're like New Yorker cartoons or even Playboy cartoons. They're pretty pretty strong. You know, they're more like pulp illustrations, except that they actually show nudity and nipples on the women, at least. Men might have noticed, Robin, in the drawings, there's no male nipples.
It's like the Ken,
you know,
doll,
you can
effect.
Have bondage and discipline, whips and chains and torture, but you know, don't go that far to actually show men with nipples. That seems to be maybe some kind of 50s taboo that even though they crossed all these other taboos, that one they didn't dare cross.
Maybe it's kind of like the Joe Matt thing where you cut out what you don't want to see.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe people are uncomfortable with male nipples. The sexuality of the men somehow is, you know, yeah, maybe it makes some people queasy.
And that kind of brings me...
I don't have nipples, but I kind of really relate to this material because of that. Maybe I shouldn't have revealed that. Is that TMI, too much information?
It makes it fun and unique. We'll go for that.
All right. Well,
it's hard to shock
me.
I've
come out on your show. I have no nipples.
There we go. Here first, folks. I don't know.
Danny Hellman's going to make fun of me.
Oh, God. I can already see the pictures.
No, something. We weren't going to mention Danny Hellman.
I haven't even mentioned his name yet.
All right. Onward and upward.
We can only go upward from here.
Hopefully he's not listening today.
Not yet.
About how I'm nippleless.
Sorry.
He'll never let me hear the end of it.
Now, the legal troubles. We were going to talk a little bit about legal troubles that would have been faced and kind of made this venture come to an end.
Well, the bizarre thing that happened is that this gang from Brooklyn got a hold of these booklets, and this gang was composed of four young men who were Jews and Nazis at the same time. The leader, Jack Coslow, sported a Hitler mustache, did his followers, and Coslow would yell Sieg Heil, Heil Hitler during the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, to the U.S. flag. You're Canadian, so maybe you don't pledge the U.S. flag either, but he
not yet.
And said Heil Hitler during this ceremony that every American child did at the beginning of each school day. So, and he got his followers to go with him out in parks at night, and they had ordered whips out of the back pages of comic books. You used to be able to buy whips and switchblades and things like that in comic books in the 50s via comic books. They ordered whips, and then they would use these implements to whip and flog girls in the park, and then they copying things that they saw in the Knights of Horror booklets, they would make bums kneel before them and kiss their feet, and they'd set these bums on fire and tortured them, and then killed a couple of these vagrants that were in the park. So they got caught and went on trial for murder, and the judge called in a psychiatrist who was famous for dealing with kids, and wanted him to interview Jack Coslow in his jail cell to find out if Jack Coslow was fit to be tried. And this psychiatrist was Dr. Frederick Wortham, the famed anti-comic book crusader. In interviewing Jack Coslow, the teenage juvenile delinquent Jewish Nazi, he found out that he took much of his inspiration from his complete collection that he had of Joe Shuster's Knights of Horror booklets. And so the government and the public and the press at the time got real upset about everything related to this. Both.
Now, was this before or after the trial, the big comic stuff?
Well, there was actually like four or five different Senate investigations and hearings and about comic books, mm-hmm, and juvenile delinquency and pornography, and the code. This was right after Brooklyn Serial Killer's trial was, I think, right after the code was formally adopted. But up until that time, after they were caught, there was all kinds of full page headlines in the newspapers and big articles and in Time and Life, Newsweek and Reader's Digest, talking about altogether the Brooklyn Thrill Killers comic books and the Knights of Horror booklets. The press kind of mishmashed it all together. And Wortham eventually, Jack Coslow and his right-fisted man, or not right-hand man, right-fisted man, because this is Melvin Mittman enjoyed, Coslow kind of had an intellectual approach to wiping out bums, but Mittman just enjoyed seeing how hard he could hit them. So they both got life imprisonment, and soon thereafter, Frederick Wortham, Dr. Frederick Wortham, was part of another investigation looking into juvenile delinquency and comic books, and he gave a whole presentation about the Knights of Horror books and had charts and graphs about how different phrases and different incidences and different illustrations in the Knights of Horror books were inspirations for the Brooklyn Thrill Killers. So they, you know, it's just kind of all tied in together in this crazy period in the mid-50s.
It's a good thing he didn't sign his name.
Well, you know, that's the amazing thing. That's one of the ways I found out about all these events and circumstances is that a fellow historian who I was talking to about these Knights of Horror booklets that Schuster illustrated, he said to me, well, it's a good thing that Dr. Frederick Wortham never found out about these. And that's when I decided to Google Dr. Frederick Wortham plus Knights of Horror, and that's when I found out. It just opened up a flood of wild, crazy information, and that's how I found out about the Brooklyn Thrill Killer. So this whole story is just, like, insane. I mean, you've got, you know, Jewish Nazi juvenile delinquents. You've got showgirls. You've got starving artists. You've got Hitler. You've got, you know, DAs, and you've got judges, and you've got the police force of New York, and you've got Supreme Court judges, and...
And you've got Superman.
And you've got Superman. You know, so it's just like this crazy story that even, like, I don't think comic book writers or pulp writers dreamed up.
Where does this come from?
This should be a movie.
It really should. If anyone's listening, make a movie.
Hello. Hollywood.
There we go. Yeah, I don't think Hollywood listens. Not to me, at least. Or else we'd have no... spirit movie.
Away from that one.
I'm gonna do another quick song break.
Okay. What are you gonna play now?
I was gonna play Bowie's Superman.
Oh, that'll work.
It's a different take. It's an alternative take off the Hunky Dory, the old Ryko disc release they did.
Okay.
And then when we get back,
I've heard this one.
You haven't?
Version.
It's a nice version. It's a lot more down-tempo. Maybe that's the wrong word. But when we come back, why don't we jump into Booty Rogers?
Oh, we'll shake our booty.
We'll that's shake our booty.
Subject. Cool.
All right. So, Inksud, CITR 101.9 FM. I'm chatting with Craig Gill, and we'll be right back.
When all the world was very young, mountain magic heavy hung, the supermen would walk in file, guardians of a loveless isle, and gloomy browed with super fear. Their endless tragic lives could heave no sigh, in solemn perverse serenity, wondrous beings chained to life. Strange games they would play then. No death for the perfect men. Life rose into one for them. So softly a super god cries. Where all were minds in unithought, powers weird by mystics taught, no pain, no joy, no power too great, colossal strength to grasp for fate, where sad-eyed mermen tossed in slumbers, nightmare dreams no mortal mind could hold. Man would tear his brother's flesh, a chance to die, to turn to mold. Far out in the red skies, far out from the sad eyes, strange mad celebrations. So softly a super god dies. Far out in the red skies, celebrations. So softly a super god dies.
CITR 101.9 FM. Ink Studs, radio show where we talk about comics. What do you think of that version?
I loved it.
That's it?
Bowie.
Bowie.
What's not to love?
Hunky Dory is my favorite album, so it's nice to have the bonus tracks that they kind of did
for the same
sessions.
It's your number one favorite album?
It's up there. It's, you know...
Now, which is it? Is it your favorite album or is it up there?
It's up there because I never made a list of my favorite albums.
Okay. Just checking.
Yeah, no, you know, there's some albums which I find are really perfect, and this is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, Buddy Rogers, wonderful, odd book from Fantagraphics came out a couple months ago, last month, this month, I can't remember.
Not too long ago, just maybe a few weeks ago.
It's looking at the art, I guess it's kind of like a amalgamation of like Basil Wolverton meets Frank Frazetta, only it came out before them. Is that a good
way?
It's like
it's crazy stuff. I mean, you have your favorite album. I have my favorite cartoonist, and that would be Buddy Rogers. I think he's the world's greatest cartoonist. Aside from just being my own personal favorite, I'm trying to tell everyone who will listen that he is the greatest cartoonist of all time. Just so wild and wacky and weird and crazy and. And yet it's just not insanity for insanity's sake. That, you know, the stories have plots and you know, there's characterization and the drawing is just incredible. It's a humorous drawing, but it's so beautifully drawn, and the girls are so sexy and fun, and, you know, I can't say high enough praise for Buddy Rogers.
Well, it's such a... It's very tight, but it seems like there's a lot of fun in what he's drawing.
He was definitely having a good time when he was doing this, and then, you know, we, the readers, benefit from that. You know, that he was laughing while he was doing this.
Now, you were able to meet him and actually correspond with him quite regularly.
Yeah, he became a very good friend of mine, and he used to visit me up here New York area, and you know, I'd stayed with him a number of times in his home out west in Texas, and you know, we would exchange letters and phone calls two and three times a week for many years. So you know, I got to be very close to him, and he was a great guy. Apart from his comics being great, he was a really nice guy and a lot of fun.
He's really fascinating. Like, he's quite different from any other comic guy I read about. I mean, born 1904. Is that the right date? I think that's the right date.
You know,
I was just looking at
the introduction. I'm going to go with what you say. I'm going to read my book to make sure.
From Fantagraphics, Inc.
The book is called Booty, Boody, you know, just like shake your booty. You know, these cartoons are kind of sexy in some ways, and fun and adventuresome and hilarious all at once.
What made him so...
But what were you going to say? Yeah, he was born in 1904. Really... In fact, he was born in the state that eventually, or the area that eventually became the state of Oklahoma in the United States, but he was born when it was just a territory. I mean, he went back.
You're saying he, like, went to Northern California to go pan for gold to make it back to New York to go work in comics.
Right.
I mean, I just that sounds incredible. Like, it sounds like he's really done all these amazing things
as well as being
a cartoonist.
In New York, around the culture there, yet, you know, he's from Oklahoma and Texas and panhandled out in California. And he was friends with all these top cartoonists like Milton Caniff and
he went to school with a lot of them, right?
Yeah, he went from Oklahoma to Chicago, and at that time there was the Chicago Academy, the art school there, had a cartooning course headed up by Cary Orr, and I think political cartoonist Shoemaker was a teacher. And so he learned from some of the greats, and while he was in Chicago, he met, like, Chester Gould, and who did Dick Tracy, and Harold Gray, who did Little Orphan Annie. So, you know, I mean, he was with, you know, he was in that era and meeting the cartoonist bigwigs in Chicago. And, he, you know, he was thrilled and hanging out with these guys.
What did they think of him?
I don't know what they thought of personally. Though I can guess everybody that knew Booty really liked him. He was just such a fun guy and loving guy and wacky and, you know, and you know, he was just a good time guy, and people really dug him. I mean, he had a beautiful family and wife and kids who really adored him, and vice versa. And he was just a terrific man, a lot of fun. But always, he always enjoyed having a good time and making people laugh, and especially through his comics and stuff. He loved his comics, you know, he loved coming up with wacky stories and ideas for them. So, and that shows so much in the work, doesn't it, Robin?
Mm-hmm. No, it's quite like, it's like a Texan take on Greek figures, this odd, like, amalgamation of different kinds of imagery to just like create this unusual world that like Richie Rich only wishes he could be a part of.
Yeah, there's like a lot of bizarre surrealism in some of the stories. When he had a kind of a superhero character, Sparky Watts, who flew by flapping his arms, and the ladies loved him, and you know, and he had all these wacky characters around him, like Slap Happy was this friend of his who had like these giant feet that were about as long as he was tall, and you know, just all these nutty characters all around him, sort of like Chester Gould villains, or you know, except that they were his friends, his enemies. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, Booty had a lot of fun in these comics. I love reading them.
And
he had another character called Babe, who was like this very strong woman figure. She was a hillbilly girl who could run faster and dive deeper, and you know, than any other person on the earth. And she was great at playing baseball and football and wrestling. And you know, she was a real character too. She took her name from Babe Dickerson, the Olympic star. But it's just like a humorous take on that. If Babe, the Olympic star, would meet, Little Abner or the Beverly Hillbillies or something, and then with throwing a bunch of wackiness too, that then you would have Babe.
What did guys like? Was he influential on people like Frazetta and Wolverton? Was that someone?
I don't know. You know, his comic strip work of Sparky Watts was mostly in small town newspapers. It was in the Brooklyn Eagle, but the comics historian friend of mine, Ron Goulart, guesses that maybe the Frank Markey syndicate was actually maybe a tax write-off for some larger syndicate, because they seemed to not sell to too many papers and just get in small towns. So his work was never really widely known, and the comic book company he worked for was a small outfit too, you know, so they didn't really get out there that much.
Because I'm just looking at the one character, the friend of Sparky, the bald guy, reminds me so much of like Powerhouse Pepper.
Oh yeah, I think so too. But whether or not, you know, I talked to Woolerton at one point in my life too, and I talked to, you know, friends with Booty, but I think I did ask Booty if he was familiar with Wolverton, and I don't think he recalled him, or if he was ever familiar with him. And I didn't get a chance to ask Wolverton if he knew Booty Rogers, but they are seemed kind of cut from the same cloth.
Mm-hmm. Then maybe that's just it. There's something in the water.
Yeah, I think so.
No, he was in the first...
I wanted to drink that water.
Oh, yeah. He was in the first comic, right?
Well, that's the newsstand comic put out by, which was the first newsstand comic book called the Comics. He had work in there. I think one of his cartooning teachers in Chicago maybe had heard that Dell was putting together a book and looking for work or something. You know, maybe they probably looking for cheap artwork. Maybe they contacted the school. They had any talented students or something. So Booty quickly got his artwork to Dell, and one of the strips was Rock Age Roy. In fact, he gave me a piece of original artwork from the first comic that featured Rock Age Roy, and you know, I treasure that piece of artwork because it's like a real historical piece. Plus, it's by the great Booty Rogers.
It's a really neat way of opening the book to see also where he started and seeing how that connects to his later work.
Yeah, he you know, I mean, he definitely was in that Grand Comics tradition, you know, and you know, he was absorbing all these great cartoonists he was meeting and learning from in Chicago. In fact, there's even some people that say there's a Chicago School of Cartooning because, you know, Booty Rogers came there, and then a friend of his, Bill Holman, who did Smokey Stover, was from that area, and I think Booty was friends with, or might have even roomed with, Tex Avery, the great animator, who was from Texas. That's how he got his name, and they both ended up in Chicago.
Who also has a wild eye.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe
they were on each other.
I'm also wondering about the influence of Harriman. I'm just looking at that page we're talking about.
Yeah, you're right. The backgrounds, I mean, they were both kind of drawing southwestern backgrounds. But, yeah, I wonder if Booty did enjoy the backgrounds that Harriman used to put in.
I mean, it's just that the backgrounds are the only thing that's kind of similar. I mean, the rest is definitely not.
Yeah, yeah. You know how animation has, like, the characters in the foreground and these incredibly beautiful backgrounds? It's almost like they're beautiful George Harriman southwestern backgrounds, yet in front of them are these wild, wacky, crazy characters that Booty was drawing.
Tell me about when you first came across a Booty Rogers comic.
That was when I was like a pretty young guy. I had gotten interested in comics and comic books and cartoonists, and going to bookstores after school, or riding my bike around the town of Akron, going to all these old bookstores, seeing if they had any comic books in the drawers or in the back room or something. Most of the time they didn't, but sometimes I'd find a nice stack. And one time at a bookstore, I found a box of musty old comics, and you know, it was like actually a big box, and I talked the owner into letting me having the box of comics at 10 cents a piece, but even at that, it was like way too much for even my money I was earning from lawn mowing. So I asked my dad if he'd float me some money, and he had to think about it. In fact, he went to the bookstore with me to make sure I wasn't getting ripped off or something. And I think he made me anguish over it more, you know, so that I would learn the value of a dollar or something, you know. So I had to go with my dad. We checked out the books, and he said, okay, I'll lend you the money, and took this box home, and thanks to my dad. And, you know, I just, like, rifled through all this old, crazy stuff. Because the EC comics and Superman comic books and Lone Ranger, but it just seemed like comics from another time, you know, and they were kind of bizarre just because they were thick and from the 1940s and many characters that I wasn't familiar with. But the one that really stood out was one of these Babe comic books by Booty Rogers. As bizarre and weird as all these horror or cowboy or funny comic books were, Booty seemed to be the most bizarre. It's kind of like spooked me out a little bit, not in a totally creepy way, but just like, wow, this is like really different, you know. So for a long time, that laid on my bedroom floor, and I don't know if I even like got around to. I would look at it, but not read it. And I think maybe I didn't even read it till years later. But I just noted it was like really different.
It blew your mind.
And then when I did finally read it, I was just cracking up. You know, funny, funny stuff. I can you tell I love Booty Rogers?
No, it's work? It comes right through.
And a lot of people, I'm getting a great reaction to this book. A lot of people are getting turned on to Booty for the first time, and you know, get pretty excited about it. So,
well, it's a good time for this kind of thing. You and the work you're doing, that Fletcher Hanks is, or Paul Karasik's doing with the Fletcher Hanks collection.
Yeah, those are great books. I love that Fletcher Hanks. In fact, again, Booty, Archer's, Fletcher Hanks are kind of similar, but very different. And in it, I think they're both crazy comic books, but I think Fletcher Hanks maybe was pretty crazy, where Booty was, you know, could get into being fun and crazy, but he was really, you know, a normal family man and a good guy. So they both kind of end up at the same spot, but coming from different directions. And Fletcher Hanks is kind of a primitive, yet the work has a power to it. Booty's work is powerful partly because it's so beautifully drawn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's not primitive in any way, in that sense.
Well, they're kind of like an opposite ends of a spectrum.
Yeah,
in some aspects, or like a neat reflection of each other. Like, here's this, like, seems like a pretty dynamic guy, and Fletcher mm-hmm. Hanks is more of an enigma that really not a lot is known.
Yeah,
about
yeah,
him.
Yeah.
Like, I'm trying to remember the Will Eisner quote about him, but it's escaping my mind. I would add to the conversation, but that just failed. I'm at the end of my time slot, my friend.
Wow, this has been great, Robin.
It's been fantastic. Thank you so much for joining me again, Craig.
It's been my great pleasure. So they're going to buy, everyone's going to buy The Secret Identity, The Fetish Art of Superman's Co-Creator, and Booty, the Bizarre Comics of Booty Rogers.
Very beautifully put together book. How much of a sample of his work is that collection?
Oh, the Booty Rogers? Oh, there's lots more good stuff. If this book does sell well, I have some ideas in mind to bring more out for the demanding public.
Well, I hardly recommend checking out, because it's nice. One of my favorite things is how you really capture the feeling of it, like of the comics, where like you look at some of those Marvel reprints and it's like, look, it's hyper glossy paper and, you know, everything's white and, you know, clean. Well,
I
you
work
see the
with
dots.
Andy Graphics, who does a great job on this kind of stuff.
Jacob Covey, he's a talented young man.
Yeah, for absolutely sure.
Yeah, thank you so much, Craig.
Okay,
and
listen, you take care.
You too. Thanks,
bye-bye.
Buddy. Bye. And that was Craig Yeo and the two books, Booty Rogers, The Bizarre Wonderful World. It's really, really fascinating, crazy collection. You just look through it, and one of the things you can just look and go, like, what the hell? And, of course, Secret Identity, The Fetish Art of Superman, co-creator Joe Shuster, which is kind of in a similar vein of oddities, but also an excellent collection. And thank you, Craig, for all your tireless efforts of putting these together. Up next is The French Connection on CITR 101.9 FM. It's just about 3 o'clock, getting close to 3 o'clock. Just before then, I'm going to play an interview I did with Chris Brandt talking about his Independence documentary, which is a look at the creative spirit within comic creators and what really makes up creativity for them. It's an interesting documentary. Check out the interview. I hope you enjoy. And I'll be back next week.
To me, the change has come, she's under my under my thumb. Well, I can still look at someone else. It's down to me. Oh, that's what I say. The way she talks when she's spoken to, down to me. The change has come. She's under my thumb. I say the song. I'm